Welcome back to Rule of Three.
Woo! What you're really here to listen to.
Yeah, baby. It's great to have you here with us today, and I am very excited to share this episode with you. I am pumped for this one.
This is going to be
legitimately
a good one.
Pumped for this one. I'm your host and spiritual guide, Sean Barber. I am joined by our resident expert in death, Miss Nicole Jewett.
Hello, Woo. Everyone.
And the man who knows nothing, Mr. Ethan Black.
Dab on him.
Speaking of Ethan, some thanks are in order this week because Ethan actually helped with something.
Yes,
wowzers. He was the one that came up with the name and the topic for this episode that we are calling One Hit Wounders.
You're welcome,
I like
audience.
It's creative.
It's pretty funny.
So today will be all about crimes of passion and people who just lost it one day, up and went psycho.
Up and killed somebody.
Including Dan Willoughby, Judy Parker, and Carol Ann Bond. After listening, make sure you go check out our Instagram at ruleof3333 to see even more of us, because why wouldn't you want to do that?
And we're trying to post more of like what we actually do behind the scenes and so that you guys can see, because we don't know if you're interested in it or not, but we'd like to think that you are.
You can see us suffering at 11 o'clock at night until 1 in the morning trying to desperately
Unless
write these scripts.
Unless you're Sean going to bed at 6 o'clock this morning finishing this script.
Listen, there's a lot of research for this one.
There was.
But I had a good time. A lot of obituaries, a lot of creeping on people in the white pages and stuff.
US Postal Service.
That's why I'm excited for this one, though, because we have a lot of really cool information that I think you guys will enjoy.
I'm excited.
So we are going to get into it. All of our episodes are posted wherever you listen to podcasts, so don't forget to go back and listen to any of them that you've missed. With all of that out of the way, we've got a lot to cover today, so let's get right into it.
Woo.
We have got three dumbass hosts, three crazy stories, and no fucking clue what we're doing. This is Rule of Three. Ethan, play us in, baby. Play us in. That was
honestly actually not painful to listen to.
Record labels, I'm coming right for
like,
you.
Usually my ears cry when Ethan plays harmonica.
When the doves cry. Bum, bum, bum.
All right.
All right. Our first story today is about Dan Willoughby. Our story starts in the early 90s with his wife, Trish Willoughby, a successful businesswoman who ran a lucrative herbal supplement business alongside her mother.
Translation. Bad bitch.
She was making paper, let me mm-hmm. tell you what. She was running a very successful business.
With her mom. Talk about lady
with mama,
power.
Yeah. It was really cute, actually. We did some digging on her mom, and she writes a lot of reviews for products on
Amazon.
She fucking ripped George Foreman apart.
A new
That's
one.
Hilarious.
Yeah, absolutely. She was
Foreman
not happy with her George Foreman grill, but that is aside the point.
Not please. I don't think that's besides the point. I think that is very pertinent to this story.
Right on the point.
You know,
I'll
allow that.
Now, her husband, Dan Willoughby, well, he was doing pretty well in his own right. He had a career as a sales manager for an international air freight company, but his success was nothing compared to the success of his wife. Like, Oof. She was on
Can't
another
touch
level.
This.
The two of them lived together in their Arizona home, along with their three children, but their marriage was far from perfect, as Dan had a secret that was about to come to light.
Hey now.
And the secret's name was Yesenia Patino.
Yesenia.
I kind of like Yesenia Patino. That's going to be my next tape name.
I was thinking about it, too, coming up to this. I was like,
I
know
I
how to
say this. I had a feeling
you were
going to
do
it.
Yesenia
Patino.
No, Yesenia Patino.
Patino.
Immigrated, yes, Yesenia Patino immigrated from Mexico to the United States with her family in 1962 when she was just 6 years old. She moved all around the country, making a living by hustling men and shoplifting.
Oh.
Like, you know. On,
like a like you.
An honest
as
day's
one
work.
Does. The American dream,
Good
really.
For you.
Until she finally settled in Mesa, Arizona, near her family. One day, Yesenia and one of her friends were walking down the street, and she threw a candy wrapper on the ground, littering, first of all, littering.
Bad.
Fine.
Littering.
Deportation.
She hates the planet.
Dan, who just happened to be passing by in his Jaguar, you know, taking it out for a spin,
oh, obviously.
Pulled over and jokingly scolded her for littering. It shouldn't have been jokingly, first of all.
Yeah.
That's a crime.
He
that's
held
a
her up
serious
at that.
That's a crime. If he had just taken pollution seriously, nothing
None
that
of
happens
would have
next would have
been. No, if he just pulled over and
attacker.
Reamed her and left, this whole story would have been
exactly.
completely avoided.
So Dan pulls over, jokes to them about littering, and then he offers to give the two ladies a ride to the mall. And upon their arrival, he gave Yesenia his phone number and offered to buy her a drink sometime.
Hey now.
Yeah.
A married man.
A married man.
Surprise, surprise. Hell no.
So Dan began the relationship as a business venture, actually, or so he says, seeing as his company had many contacts in Mexico and he wanted to expand into Central and South American countries, he wanted Yesenia to be a Spanish teacher. Now, in my mind, if I wanted a Spanish teacher, I think I would just go and get, like,
a Spanish teacher.
Somebody, you know, who's certified in teaching Spanish, not just some random girl who apparently can't even keep her wrappers in her pants. They got to be on the ground.
Well, you don't want them in your pants, because if you're hustling men, you can't do that.
Crinkle, crinkle, crinkle.
That just sounds weird.
But yeah, he gets this random woman to be his Spanish teacher. Spanish teacher.
And I don't even know that I buy that.
No, like, not at all.
Like,
not
oh,
for
I
a
really
second.
Just wanted her as a Spanish teacher, and then we fell in love. No, you didn't, Dan.
Not
you
for
just
one
couldn't
second.
Keep it in your pants and needed to come up with any excuse possible to even fathom cheating on your wife.
Yeah.
Wow, bars.
So a few weeks later, Dan introduces Yesenia to his family and just tells them that she's his Spanish teacher, and that's that.
And apparently, they all were like, okay.
Yeah, sure. Soon, though, their relationship became much more. The two began seeing each other all the time, and Dan even took Yesenia on a couple business trips to Mexico. Dan was able to give her a much more luxurious life than she was used to, and before long, Yesenia was moving into an upscale apartment just down the street from the Willoughby's home at Trish's expense.
Because remember, she's the big kahuna in this relationship.
Trish is the one with the paper, and she was footing the bill for Yesenia to live in a nice house right down the road from them.
And pipe her mans.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Damn.
Unfortunately for Dan, his attempts to learn Spanish, they ended up being useless anyway, because he lost his job at the air freight company in July of 1990.
Karma.
This could have become a problem for Dan, though, I'm sure, as you can figure out, because he was completely supporting Yesenia, paying all of her bills and taking her on trips. But not to worry, Dan's brilliant solution for this was to simply make Trish pay for everything from now on.
Easy.
Later that same year, Trish was beginning to grow suspicious of her husband and his Spanish teacher. And when she started having trouble getting a hold of him, Yesenia's apartment was the first place she decided to look.
Obviously.
You know,
smart woman.
I wonder if Dan, like, ever showed any signs of knowing any Spanish at all. You know, like, if he's supposedly
apparently learning
Spanish.
Can I have another glass of agua? Yes,
apparently,
you can,
he would, like, take his kids over to her apartment complex to go to the pool, like, for the afternoon, and he'd be sitting there with his Spanish homework. So it sounds like he was, like, learning Spanish at this time.
Interesting.
But it wasn't his primary focus.
Yeah.
Instead of learning with the side of sex, it was sex with the side of learning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was, he was all about that taco, if you know what I mean.
Mm. Hey now.
I hate you. Anyway, moving right along. So Trish marched right over to Yesenia's apartment, busted in the bedroom, and there, guess what she found? Dan putting
learning
on
Spanish.
His shirt.
Oh.
No.
Oh, whoops.
With his pencil out.
Putting on. Oh, ooh. With his pencil out.
Oof.
Anyway, that alone isn't, like, that bad. Like, oh, yeah, he didn't have a shirt on. Like, you could have seen a lot worse things.
She spilled
but
agua on his shirt.
It's just bad in general.
Pantalones.
So she didn't find Yesenia, though, because she was hidden in the bedroom. Like, imagine, like,
the horror movie where,
like, a movie, like, she's stuck
they're under
the bed.
I like how it's her room and she's the one that's hiding.
Yeah.
What?
It's like you'd think the first thought would be for Dan to be hidden because it doesn't make sense for Dan to be in there, but no, they hid her instead.
Nah, he just pushed that bitch in a closet and called it a day.
So later that day, Dan called Yesenia to warn her that Trish was going over later to confront her, and he coached Yesenia through exactly what to say. Deny everything and insist you are my Spanish teacher. So sure enough.
Hola.
Just say
hola.
No me
soy
no hablo
Spanish teacher.
Inglés.
I don't even know if what I just said was correct in any aspect. I took French in high school, so we're just going to move right along.
I took Italiano.
So, sure enough, Trish arrived the next day and said to Yesenia, "My understanding, Yesenia, is that you're going out with my husband." First of all, she had every right to go in there and, like,
light
tear
a bitch
shit
up. Light a bitch up.
And she didn't.
Just nice and calm. I understand you're going out with my husband.
What's that all about?
Just fucking factual, too. Not even like, Yesenia, is there anything going on that I should know about? Just no. You're going out with my husband. What's up with that?
You want to tell me about that? So Yesenia, though, stuck to exactly what she was told and denied any wrongdoing and even volunteered to stop tutoring Dan if it was going to be a problem.
Hey.
Despite this promise, though, Dan and Yesenia continued to see each other.
Oh, I don't lie.
In February of 1991, the Willoughbys took a family vacation to a beachside resort in Mexico. One day, Dan loaded up all the children into the car and headed off to a local museum, but Trish stayed behind, supposedly to take a nap.
Taking a snooze.
Uh-huh. A siesta, as we are in Mexico. A little while later, Dan and the children returned from their outing, and he told the kids to go in and tell their mother what they saw at the museum.
Aw.
So the kids
Just hold on.
The kids ran in, expecting to find their mother asleep, but instead found her laying with a pillow covering her head and blood all over the bedroom.
The scene was pretty gnarly. We saw it, too.
It was disgusting. Soon, the Mexican police arrived on the scene, and they took a few photos of the crime scene, but didn't have the proper equipment to gather fingerprints or other forensic evidence. They declared that the scene looked like a robbery, since Dan said $400 and Trish's rings were missing, but back in Arizona, the police were getting some interesting tips about Dan Willoughby. Arizona detective Joseph Ruett claimed to have received numerous phone calls saying, "I can't believe Dan Willoughby finally killed his wife."
And that doesn't sound very good now, does it?
That's not good for you. That's not good.
People didn't call and say, "Oh, you know, I kind of have some information about the Willoughbys. Dan and his wife kind of didn't get along." No, they literally said, "I can't believe that crazy bastard finally did it."
The mad lad. He fucking killed his wife.
He offed his lady. He really did it.
Wow. Well,
not even calling, like, "Do you have any, like, information?" No, like, "Oh, you finally fucking killed her, huh?"
Can't it's
about
believe
time.
It.
Christ. Come on. What?
Several people.
Not up or shut up, Dan.
It was an odds.
Oh my God. Several people said that they knew Dan was cheating on Trish for years, and some of his business colleagues even said that when Dan said he was going to Digital, a company that they often did business with, everybody knew that he really meant he was just going to be with a woman for the rest of the afternoon. Like, that was his code word, was going to Digital.
So Dan would just be at work and he'd be like, "All right, lads, see you later, I'm going to Digital." And they were like, mm-hmm,
they're like,
sure
aye, chief.
You're about to go get your dick wet, aren't you, Dan?
Yeah.
Nope, couldn't do it.
No.
Continue.
Digital?
I was aiming for that, but I couldn't. I choked.
Now, just like that, all the fingers were pointing right at Dan, and investigators realized that surely Dan would gain millions of dollars from his wife's life insurance policy, as well as inheriting her position at the company. A little more digging revealed that Dan was not only paying Yesenia's rent, but also her membership at a local health club, and putting money in a joint checking account that the two of them shared. Like, how?
Because
that's so obvious.
Because I, too, have a joint checking account with my Spanish teacher.
Oh, well, why wouldn't you?
Everyone does,
she
don't they?
She needs the pesos.
Oh, my God.
If that wasn't bad enough, during the investigation, Dan and Yesenia were off buying matching diamond rings and taking engagement photos. Come to find out, Dan and Yesenia had actually gotten engaged in the fall of 1990, meanwhile assuring Trish that nothing was going on between them. And now that Trish was out of the picture, they were free to make their relationship public.
So they got engaged around the same time that Trish went to Yesenia's apartment.
They were engaged,
so they were
the
engaged
entire time.
The whole time.
Now,
dirty bastard.
And they lied right through their teeth.
Now, at this point, detectives brought Dan in for questioning, and at first, he behaved just like a grieving husband should, you know, showing remorse and, you know, "Oh, why did this happen?" And, you know, like, like your wife got killed,
yeah,
something,
you know,
like that.
You know, maybe showing an emotion, like a tear every now and again.
But when they started pressing for details about his finances, he became noticeably uncomfortable.
I think they said he was, like, profusely sweating.
Yeah, that's pretty nasty. He also is in Arizona, so...
That's true. Everyone is profusely sweating in Arizona.
Also, finances,
I don't know how people live there.
That's a rough topic.
Yeah. But Dan admitted that he would gain millions of dollars from Trish's life insurance, but insisted he was happily married and wouldn't dream of having an affair.
Plot twist. He was happily married, just
to
not
Yesenia.
To Trish.
No, happily engaged.
Excuse me.
Meanwhile, the police began investigating Yesenia as well, and when they asked for identification, she had some interesting news. She handed over a social security card with the name Alfredo Patino.
Alfredo.
First of all, who names
Let
their kid fucking Alfredo?
Let that sink in for a second.
Like the sauce.
Sure.
Yeah, but Alfredo is typically a man's name.
Yeah.
Turns out, Yesenia was transgender and had a gender reassignment surgery in the 80s.
Which I want to know, like, not that it really matters, but I'm just curious. I wonder if Dan knew.
Yeah.
Because theoretically, there's no way he would have known unless she told him.
Plot twist.
I have no idea what, like, the whole story behind that is. I know at, like, the end of the case when stuff started getting figured out that, like, the fact that Yesenia was transgender, absolutely, like, the media blew that shit up. And, like,
yeah,
they could not escape it. And they did, like, the media didn't even care about the trial or anything. Like, they were so focused on the fact that Yesenia was transgender that it just...
She went from peen to poon. Who knew it?
Oh, my God.
In the simplest terms possible, you're not wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, while police were searching Yesenia at the station, they found the rings in her purse that were later confirmed as Trish's rings that went missing at the scene of the crime.
Oh no, Alfredo.
And Yesenia, oh, no. Get this, when they found them, she's like, some guy sold those to me as I was walking on the beach. I didn't know who he was.
Yeah,
yes, Ringo's
okay.
Gringo. It's like, what did you say? What?
She admitted to being in Mexico that weekend, but she said she was out partying with friends and completely denied having any involvement in Trish's murder. Yesenia, though, had an outstanding warrant for shoplifting, so Mesa police arrested her for that warrant, but released her a few days later on March 5th. Little did they know, the day before she was released, Arizona police had been flown out to Mexico to further investigate the scene and ended up taking fingerprints from a Coke bottle that matched Yesenia's, placing her at the scene the day that Trish was murdered. Now, authorities had everything they needed to formally charge Yesenia with Trish's murder, except they had one small problem. Yesenia was nowhere to be found.
The plot thickens.
Vanish.
So, Trish's family underwent a huge search effort, plastering the border with missing posters, bought advertising space, putting ads on the sides of buses, and keeping her face in the media, offering a $6,000 reward for information that would lead to her capture. The media exposure finally paid off in December when they received a tip that Yesenia was working at a bar in Mexico and was soon arrested. She gave an incredibly detailed confession to the police, saying that it all started 3 months before Trish's death, when she first confronted Yesenia about the affair. She gave Dan an ultimatum, Trish or her. Dan chose Yesenia, originally saying he would divorce Trish, but quickly coming up with a murder plot in order to inherit her insurance money and use the payoff to escape with Yesenia to Mexico. Dan told Yesenia he needed her help, though, and her job was to sneak into the vacation house while he and the kids were away to make the murder look like a robbery, as Dan had already bludgeoned Trish to death in her sleep before he left the house. Yeah. So he literally said, okay, kids, go get in the car. I'll be there soon. Went in, killed their mother by beating her to death, and then got in the car and left. And then Yesenia was going to come in and, like, steal some things and, like, move shit around,
holy
fuck shit up,
shit.
And make it look
that
like a robbery.
Is brutal. Just
yeah.
Absolutely brutal.
That's awful.
So, Yesenia did admit to stabbing Trish in the head, though, but claimed it was out of mercy, since Trish was still barely alive and she could hear her moaning in pain, so she stabbed her through the temple with a butter knife to deliver the final blow.
Can you imagine laying there in your bed, a pillow over your face,
bleeding out,
and you just got your entire skull crushed in, and you just have to lay there dying?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God.
That's fucked.
I wonder if, like, she was conscious or alive enough to, like, see Yesenia.
I doubt it.
I doubt it, too, but...
Especially with the pillow over her face.
Well, I mean, she had to take the pillow off to stab her.
Stab her, yeah. Yesenia was probably the one that left the pillow there.
That's true.
Probably not. She probably didn't realize it was Yesenia, but still, like, just that little thought.
Can you imagine noticing that your husband is beating you to death, though? Like, in the middle of it?
Yeah.
Like, that's just...
I don't know why I laughed at that.
Wait,
that
because,
bad.
Like, that's true. She was asleep. Like, imagine waking up to just be like, honey, what are you doing?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Where, like, if you get hit once, sometimes that's all it takes. But, like, if he had to hit her multiple times...
Yeah.
She was up and...
Conscious, oh, yeah.
She was taking it like a champ. So good for you, Trish.
Rough.
Oof. Anyway,
R.I.P.
The day after Yesenia's confession, Dan was also arrested, and in April of 1992, his trial began. By May, he had been convicted and sentenced to death. So that was a pretty speedy turnaround.
Yeah, thank God.
Meanwhile, Yesenia was sent back to be tried in Mexico and pled guilty to murder. She was expected to be handed a light sentence due to her plea, but the judge sentenced her to the maximum sentence of 35 years in prison. In 1995, Yesenia wrote a letter to the judge who sentenced Dan to death by saying she murdered Trish all by herself and that Dan was completely innocent. In November of 1999, on an unrelated note, the judge overturned Dan's conviction since he believed Dan's defense poorly represented him. This time around, the prosecution didn't pursue the death penalty because now Yesenia's testimony couldn't be trusted because she said one thing at first and then went back on it. Nobody knew which one of them was the truth. Dan's new defense hoped to get him completely off the hook, since now Yesenia had said that he was completely innocent. But in the 2001 trial, she stuck to her original story that Dan did participate in the murder. He was subsequently found guilty for a second time, but this time was handed two consecutive life sentences instead of the death penalty. On November 20th, 2018, Dan died of apparent natural causes in prison.
Well.
And that's it. That's
all she wrote.
Yeah.
Hey now.
That one just really disturbs me because of all, like, the behind-the-scenes scheming
that
went on.
It's like a soap opera.
It really was.
Yeah. A lot of these stories are like that. They, like, have a really in-depth plot behind them.
When Yesenia became Alfredo, I was like, what?
Yeah. But again, that's what a lot of the media sources just picked up on, and that's all they talked about. They didn't give a shit about the murder or anything. They were just
boy went
girl 2000s. And went, like, lost their minds.
Yeah.
So even now, like... it's stupid because some people would find out that, like, oh, the successful businessman's having an affair. with a transgender person? What?
Yeah, they'd absolutely
But
lose
it happens
their minds.
A lot more than you'd think. And there's a lot of people who don't admit to being into that. A lot of people with power. Same reason why a lot of people that are really powerful get away with child pornography because they're rich and they can.
Yep. Yeah, it's a rough world that we live in.
So when people
really
find
is.
Out about that, they just blow it up and
just
completely forget about all the details.
Just be poor.
You'll have a better heart.
Yeah, that's true.
That's true.
I feel or like kill them.
Something must happen to you when you get a lot of money that just flicks a switch in your brain that's like, any like wrong things that you've ever wanted to do in your life, do it right now. Just do it.
Because you can.
Yeah, because you can, exactly. Because you know you can get away with it. It's a rough world.
It really is.
But Trisha's mother is still doing good,
by the way.
Yeah, she has written a couple of books, and she's still a very successful woman, still very rich, so she's doing a great job.
Yay, Mama Trish.
You keep up the good work. We're going to move on to our next story on Carol Ann Bond. This story is about a vengeful biologist whose crimes went all the way to the Supreme Court.
The head honchos
the big
of
boys.
The United States justice system.
Carol Ann Bond, 34 years old, was living a peaceful life in Lansdale, Pennsylvania with her husband, Clifford Bond, that she had been with for 14 years. Carol and Clifford.
All I could imagine was the big red dog.
The big red
dog. And we're just going to move on from that.
Absolutely. So Carol and Clifford, by all accounts, had a good life and marriage together. Carol worked as a microbiologist at Ramon Haas Laboratory.
Ramen.
A company. Ramon. Ramon Haas Laboratory.
Well, it's Ram and Haas.
It's German
But when you
shit.
Say it together, Ramen it just sounds like Ramon.
Ramon Haas.
It's German, you know.
German.
They got weird names.
Oh, Germans.
So she was working at a laboratory that specialized in making high-end chemicals for large-scale distribution. One small issue in Carol's life, though, was that she had recently been told that she was unable to have any children of her own.
Aww. Which is really sad for people that...
Want to have kids.
Want to have kids, yeah.
Now, although she couldn't have children herself, Carol was thrilled to find out that her best friend, Melinda Haynes, was pregnant in 2006.
Aw, yay.
But she was less thrilled when she discovered that her husband, Clifford, was the one that got Melinda pregnant.
No, Clifford, why?
I wish you could see Ethan's face when
Clifford,
we said that.
No.
He was so happy and full of pure glee, and then we just brought the hammer of truth down.
Clifford, no.
If you want to see Ethan's face and his reactions, you can always come watch us live 5:30 on our Instagram, Rule of 3333. We stream every episode live, so you can come see Ethan's face.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you can't watch it right now, it'll be on our story for 24 hours. So.
I'm not sure you'd ever want to see Ethan's face more than you have to, but you could if you so chose.
Flame Ethan up part two.
I hope
the electric boogaloo
gets you pregnant.
Now, after Carol found out, she vowed to make Melinda's life a living hell, and that's a scary fucking threat coming from a scientist.
You're damn right it is.
I would, too, if I studied biology on a microscopic scale.
This is why you're a music major. Yeah, she's a microbiologist.
Okay.
Eat shit. I
remember
things.
That at least made sense, what Ethan said. So.
Yeah, I remember things.
Carol started off just with harassing Melinda with phone calls and letters. You know, your typical vanilla harassment. But she was about to get much more sinister. Carol did what she knew best, and that was chemistry.
Which I find funny, because that's the opposite of what I can do best. Just ask my freshman year chemistry teacher.
In order to get back at Melinda, Carol devised a plan to use lethal chemicals to exact her revenge. From her job at Ramon Haas, Carol was able to steal about 4 pounds of 10-chloro-10-H
phenoxacine.
Does that translate to bomb?
No.
I'll tell you what it is. And she also ordered a vial of potassium dichromate from Amazon.
Why do that when you just have bananas?
Not quite the same.
It's not the same thing at all.
If you take a banana and paint it chrome twice, does that count?
Nope.
Are you sure?
Not
what
at
about
all.
Three times?
No, because dye is two.
No, I know, but three is the lucky number.
Wait, is dye two?
Yeah,
dye is two.
Yeah, haha. So potassium dichromate is a chemical that is insanely corrosive if it comes into contact with skin or is injected. And the chloro whatever one, that one is also very lethal. Both of them are lethal, even in fairly small doses, but potassium dichromate can kill with just a quarter teaspoon if it's ingested. This shit's gnarly.
That's a small motherfucker.
So Carol mixed the two of these together to create a super lethal and corrosive chemical, but it also turned bright orange, which is a little problem. Carol started to spread her lethal mixture on Merlinda's car door, mailbox, letters, front doorknob, and her car's muffler in an attempt to exact her revenge, but the fluorescent orange color gave the substance away.
You know what I just realized, which is like an interesting side note? What? The three of us all say orange differently.
Orange.
You say orange like orange. One syllable. Ethan says orange, and I say orange, like with two syllables.
We're all fucking weirdos.
Wait, say it.
Orange.
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 Nice. Ta-da. Dorange.
Geographic differences in language. Anyway, moving
Dorange. On. Dorange.
Merlinda noticed the chemical almost every time and notified the police, but they did very little to help her, telling Merlinda that it was probably just cocaine and to wash her hands, which I find an issue with because, first of all,
who's rubbing
if it is cocaine, the police should still be concerned about that. Yeah. Because that means somebody is rubbing cocaine on her door.
I just like to imagine 911. Hey, what's your problem? There's some shit on my door. All right, clean it up. Bye. Like, what do you want to, like, what?
And also, who in their right mind is wasting cocaine by rubbing it all over shit?
Someone who's done way too much cocaine.
And what purpose would that accomplish?
I would like to point out, though, this town that they're living in, Lansdale, is a suburb of Philly.
Yeah, I know where Lansdale is.
Hey, look at that.
Woo!
Yeah, this happened, like, in your home area.
Yeah, it's not too far. Lansdale,
so,
yeah.
Nice.
Merlinda understandably got fed up with the lack of help and contacted the local post office and told them about Carol going into her mail, which certainly got their attention. Now, Carol's a scary person and you don't want to fuck with chemists, but you know who you really don't want to fuck with?
Super
the
chemists.
U.S. Postal Service.
Oh.
The Postal Service takes crimes involving mail incredibly seriously as they handle millions of private correspondences that cannot be tampered with. In fact, they have an entire branch of postal investigators called the Office of Investigations that handle crimes exactly like what Carol's doing. So after Merlinda reported that Carol was tampering with her mail, postal investigators set up a 24-hour surveillance camera to capture the crime on tape, and they got footage of Carol putting the chemicals on a business letter and in the muffler of Merlinda's car. With this evidence and an investigation at the Ramen Haas that discovered Carol had stolen the chemicals, Carol was arrested and placed in a holding cell at the Philadelphia Post Office, which I just think is funny that, like,
they have a
post
holding
offices
cell.
Have holding cells.
Yeah.
Isn't that hilarious?
I want to get locked in a post office.
Like, it makes sense, but you just never think about the post office, like, doing more than delivering your mail.
Well, absolutely not, because they're not, like, the police office. Like, yeah. They're just, they're post office.
But they are a branch of the government,
it's
just like
wild.
The FBI. They do all the same stuff.
Can you imagine hitmen strictly for mail-related crimes?
Hmm?
There was actually a guy that, like, came into my CJ class this semester and was talking about how he works in New York City, like, with some form of, like, the Postal Service, and they seized, like, millions of pounds of cocaine last year was being sent through the mail, or like money that's come from drug deals and stuff. Like, it's a legit thing.
That's only the stuff that they managed to catch too.
Exactly.
There's so many illegal
and
things
if you
that
think
go through
about
the mail.
Like that much drugs, they have to send them in such little quantities that they won't be discovered.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So
yeah.
How many?
It's tiny packages just over and over and over again.
Yeah.
How many did they have to find to get that much out of all those little single envelopes?
But can you imagine thinking that you're this, like, chemist mastermind who's going to kill, you know, the lady who was fucking
cheating
around with your husband?
Yeah.
And you get caught by the post office.
That's like some Dexter's Laboratory shit.
Like a slap in the face.
No, not the mailman.
Also, wait, I'm confused. What was the orange chemical supposed to do?
Kill her.
It was supposed to kill her.
But why didn't it? Like, if she touched it.
Well, because
she noticed it because it was bright orange.
Yeah, it was
if
bright
orange. If it had
been
colorless, she never would have known and probably would have touched it, and then it would have burned her hands. She probably would have touched her mouth at some point and ingested it and killed herself.
Yeah. Like, it was obvious that something was going on. Merlinda called the police many times to report the substance. Like, she saw it all the time.
Yeah.
I feel like as a chemist, you should be able to know that change the color somehow. I don't know. Just anything else.
Yeah, I don't know.
So, once questioned, Carol confessed to her crimes of theft and use of a chemical weapon. In total, Carol used her chemical 24 times to try to kill Merlinda, but the worst injury Merlinda suffered was a burned thumb. Now, Carol's trial is actually really interesting, and it's one you might recognize if you've studied law, in which case we're really sorry because we're probably about to butcher this in the most, like, plain Jane words possible.
I tried my best to, like, explain it, but I don't know.
So, just about every homicide or attempted homicide, and pretty much every criminal case is heard by state courts. But in Carol's case, it was sent to federal court because of her use of deadly chemicals. Lawmakers originally labeled Carroll's use of chemicals as chemical warfare, which would fall under the Chemical Weapons Convention, or CWC, which is meant to protect nations from chemical wars.
Mm-hmm.
At this trial in 2007, Carroll was found guilty under this convention and was found guilty of 2 counts of possessing and using a chemical weapon and 2 counts of mail theft. Again, don't fuck with the Postal Service.
God, nope.
For these crimes, Carroll was sentenced to 6 years in prison and fined a total of $12,000. She spent her time in prison in a jail in West Virginia and was released in 2012, but then appealed her case to the Supreme Court, which in 2011 revealed that she shouldn't have been tried under the CWC at all, and her case should have gone to state court instead, where her crimes would have received most likely a 6-month sentence instead of 6 years.
Yeah.
That's this Supreme Court decision was influential in deciding that individuals can use the 10th Amendment as defense to protect themselves from the federal government.
So this case is a bit of a double whammy. We do have the crime of passion and the one-hit wonder, and also a Supreme Court case to go along with it. And there were two Supreme Court decisions.
Yeah, so there's one in 2011 and one in 2014.
Wow, this is like fairly recent then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this was really recent, actually. So it's interesting because I don't know. It's just an interesting trial all around because, like, obviously she did stuff wrong, but then the Supreme Court was like, all right, listen, it wasn't that bad, all right?
Yeah.
Like, if she had killed somebody, it would have been different.
Technically, she was using a chemical weapon, but she wasn't using it like mustard gas, to wipe out an entire country's population.
She's going to go to her car and drive around, and she's going to get burns on them. That'll teach her.
Yeah, and that's what the Supreme Court decided, too. They were like, listen, this treaty is for, like, gas attacks in World War I. It's not you burned your thumb. That's just not what it's for. So, yeah, an interesting case all around.
Seemed like a killer prosecution at first, but then you're like, really, dude? Like, take it about 25% off.
Can you imagine going to court and, like, the people arguing against you would be like, yeah, she violated the Chemical Weapons Convention. And you're like, oh, fuck.
Yeah, I would be like, uh-oh.
Do we have, like, a where are they now type thing? Like, do we find any current information on that?
Carol, her whole case was very difficult to find any information on. Like, all the information that we had, that took me hours to find. So I couldn't find anything about, like, what she's doing now, her husband or Melinda. Like,
I'm just thinking what happened, because there was no other further mention of Clifford in the story. So Clifford came, knocked Melinda up, and then dip sauced, I guess.
I have no idea what happened, because, like, this isn't a huge case, really.
Yeah.
And, like, the people involved were, again, like, it wasn't hugely important.
It was
kind
of like a bunch of nobodies who
cases like that, privacy is, like, usually upheld fairly well. Yeah. Like, it took me forever to find Clifford's name. It took me a long time just to find that name.
Wow.
Yeah.
The real big deal in this was the fact that it went to the Supreme Court. So there's a fuck ton of information about that. But not really about what actually happened before, about the Supreme Court cases. Yeah.
In the Supreme Court cases, they don't decide guilty or not guilty either. They don't care about what happened. They care about how does the Constitution apply to that situation. So in the cases, they don't go over the whole background of what she did, really.
So looking for that was pretty hard because most of the information we could find had nothing to do with that.
Yeah. All right, we are going to get started on our last story of the day, and this one is fucked up.
I'm so excited.
Let me tell you what. So our last story is about Judy Parker, a sociopath who tore her family apart for money. Judy was born in 1969.
Summer of 69. Nice.
She was born to a poor family in Texas, and she spent her early years finding any way she could to get out of her situation. Judy would later say that her childhood was full of sexual assaults and abuse. Desperate to get away from home, she left at age 14 with a guy from her town named Roy Hicks, and the two got married at age 15.
Little life tip for you. If you want to have a good life, maybe don't marry someone with the last name Hicks.
Or don't get married at fucking 15.
Yeah,
or
really.
That.
So Roy Hicks wasn't much better than the life that she was living before, and he was very abusive. In 1985, she gave birth to her first child at age 16, a daughter named Christina, and just a year later, her son Daniel followed. The young family didn't have much money at all. In fact, they slept on a mattress above a bar, since that was the only living accommodation that they could afford. Throughout this marriage, Judy had many affairs and was still looking for a way out of her low-income status. 3 years later, in 1988, she left Roy and began raising her children on her own, taking up a job selling vacuums door-to-door to make ends meet. Soon, she met John Parker, a young salesman rising quickly through the company, and the two started dating at age 19. Their relationship seemed to go well at first, as John became the surrogate father of Christina and Daniel, and then they had a daughter together named Tiffany in 1992. A year after this, Judy and John got married and had their second daughter, Erica, in 1997.
Damn, so, like, she's really pumping out kids.
Yeah, she really was. It's seeming like this whole life is really going well for Judy all of a sudden.
And then...
And she's got money. Strong.
Yeah. Everything was looking good as John opened his own vacuum franchise, actually, and was very successful, making his first million by age 29.
Which is extremely impressive.
The Vacuum King. Judy and John moved to an upscale neighborhood in the Ellendale Farms subdivision in Crown Point, Indiana. Like, that is the whitest thing I think I've
that
just about
like
ever
31%
heard. The Ellendale Farms subdivision in Crown Point, Indiana.
Whoa.
And
sounds like you need to go to the Kentucky Derby, yeah. is what it sounds like.
And honestly, at that point, Judy had made it. Yeah. She had made it. Like, that. She made a good life.
You peaked.
For Judy and her children, though, this new lifestyle with money was a total 180 from their previous life, and they started to take it for granted.
Aww.
So Christina and Daniel started to go off the rails a little bit, being very bratty and entitled, basically just turned into little shits because now they were rich.
Yeah.
Daniel even took his stepfather's car out for a little joyride when he was 12 and smashed up all the neighbors' mailboxes, which, like we just learned, don't fuck with the postal service. You can't do that. Like, yeah. It's bad. So,
12 years old, though. He just took his dad's car and thought it was cool.
Yeah.
12 years old.
And how he managed to get it around enough to wreck all the neighbor's mailboxes.
That didn't really, like, sink in on me when I first read it, but then I was like, 12?
Yeah. 12 years old.
Like, he's not 15 or anything. Like, yeah, he should be driving soon. No. 12 years old.
You can barely make TNT in Minecraft.
Like, he probably didn't even have any pubes, and he was taking his dad's car out.
Oh, lack of pubes. That's a rough one.
Yeah.
Anyway... Through all the problems that his children created, John was an incredibly supportive stepfather and helped them out of trouble many times so that they would have a better chance at life. Daniel and Christina were certainly causing a lot of problems.
Cons.
It was nothing compared to what Judy had in store.
Really?
Although John was giving Judy an amazing life, one that she most likely wouldn't have had on her own, Judy was a terrible mother and wife for her family.
She sucked.
People who knew Judy and her family say, and this is all kind of just like hearsay, none of this is confirmed, but they said that Judy would sleep with anyone she could and hoard her daughter out for drugs. Not the kind of behavior you would expect from a millionaire.
One comment online, somebody said that she knew Judy before all this happened, said that she was the office whore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Judy,
not great.
No.
Yeah.
No, Judy.
No, actually, no. Wait.
Judy.
What's the husband's name?
John.
John, no.
Yeah. Poor John, really.
Yeah. Real talk.
It's fuck Judy. Poor John.
Fuck Judy, dude.
So Judy would later go on to claim that John even sexually assaulted her, but again, people who knew the family called bullshit on that, saying that Judy was treated like a queen and took complete advantage of John's fortune. Again, nobody really knows what happens behind closed doors. We're just saying that from the way the family looked at the outside, it didn't look like that was really true.
In later interviews, Daniel said that, like, occasionally John would be a little hard on them. But also, when you're fucking stealing your dad's car at 12, no shit.
That's called discipline.
Yeah, so I think they just had a whole twisted idea of, like, what parenting was.
Yeah.
So, because they weren't parented before.
Exactly.
Yeah. For some reason, Judy desperately wanted to get out of her marriage to John, but she was also a greedy monster. You see, Judy could have simply filed for divorce, which would have given her half of John's business and a large settlement.
That's
but
horseshit.
She wanted more. If John was to somehow die, Judy would get everything, including his entire business and the $1 million life insurance policy that John had taken out on himself.
She was going for it all.
She's going full all
or nothing.
Chips in.
Yeah, all in. So we don't have a lot of dates for what comes next, as most of the information comes from anecdotes and interviews of, like, just random people. But all of these events must have happened in at least a 3-year window starting about in 2012.
Jesus Christ.
2000, not 2012. Don't know where I was going with that. So Judy wanted John dead, and her first attempt at gaining his hard-earned fortune was through lacing his food with ecstasy. But this was not as effective as Judy had hoped, and John was fine, and he thought he had only gotten food poisoning.
So, like, she tried to drug his food, basically, but he was just like, "Ah, oh, my tummy hurts," and that
Can
was that. And Judy was like,
like,
"For fuck's sake, dude!"
That also doesn't really
sleep?
Make much
to
sense
die?
To me.
It's like, no, it's like
I'm not sure what lacing it with ecstasy would do.
Like, he might have been stone cold tripping, but.
I don't know.
I don't really think it would have killed him. Like, she could have done
lethal?
Arsenic.
Yeah.
I feel like any drug in a high enough quantity
Absolutely.
Is lethal.
Oh, yeah, but, like, I feel like that's just a very odd choice. That's probably
right,
what she
yeah.
could get her hands on,
yeah.
though. if you think about it.
That
like,
was what
I wouldn't be surprised if she like fucking had it in her purse and she's like, oh, this will do.
Probably.
Whipping up some pasta one night and just like, ah, here we go.
After her first attempt failed, Judy kicked it up a notch and decided to hire a hitman to carry out the job.
Mm-hmm.
However, the hitman took Judy's money and never actually followed through. Judy tried once more with another hitman, but this resulted in the same outcome as the first.
Fucking fool.
One of the hitmen notified the police about the job, but they never informed any of their supervisors about the tip and didn't reach out to John himself. And the other hitman told John, but John didn't even believe him. Yeah.
It just boggles my mind. If some guy came up to me and was like, hey, I'm a hitman. Your wife just hired me to kill you.
Or at least if you were, like, faking being a hitman.
Yeah, I feel like I would have a couple questions. A couple concerns.
I would at least be suspicious. Like, alarm bells would be raised. Yeah. I
John was
just
like,
nah,
Judy's great.
Nah.
What are you talking about? She made me some pasta last night. That shit slapped. A little bit too much on the sauce, but that shit was great.
You mean the office sauce. Whore? No, she couldn't possibly want to get rid of me.
She's my office whore. What are you talking about?
So after both of the hitmen failed to do what Judy had planned, she moved on to her next idea, having her children find young kids to kill her husband. Mom of the year.
You're fucking kidding
me. A-plus mom.
Judy gave her son, Daniel, thousands of dollars to find people willing to do it. And Daniel found these two kids at school, Crown Point High School, that said they would do it, but again, they took the money and disappeared. In 2002, the two kids that Daniel tried to hire were caught with the money at a halfway house where they were living, which was then reported to the school's resource officer, and the police got involved, eventually confiscating the money. When the two kids were questioned, they admitted that they got the money from Daniel, who asked them to take care of his stepdad. The kids also said that they never planned to actually carry out the murder, they just wanted the money and to scam Daniel. At this point, Judy was getting sick of all her murder plots failing, so she took it into her own hands.
Like,
it's kind of like, if you want something done right, you do it yourself.
Well, she's got to be thinking, how many fucking times does a woman have to try to kill her husband? Like, this is fucking sexist. Poor woman trying to kill her husband, and society's against me all of a sudden.
I just like how, literally, this is literally three strikes and you're out. This is the third time there's been something about someone trying to kill John.
The fourth time. There's the poison, hitmen.
But the person getting out, because the first hitman talked to John.
Oh, right. Okay.
The other one talked to the police, and this time the kids got caught, and they were like, yeah, Dan wanted me to knock his old man to the ground and beat him to death. It's like, whoa.
So a lot of, like, hitman services and stuff, you see, like, oh, on the dark web, you can hire hitmen or whatever. Those are almost all, like, FBI agents and stuff that, like, if you actually try to hire them, they're just going to come arrest your ass.
It's kind of like stuff in, like, child sex rooms and shit like that. Like, 90% of the people that you try to meet are, like, undercover officers.
Yeah,
like,
and if you try to do any of that, they will get you.
Yeah, you'll pull up there and be like, oh, doop-a-doo, gonna meet a kid.
So don't
and
fuck
then
around with
like,
the dark
nope.
web, kids.
Yeah.
Don't fuck with scientists, the postal service, or the dark web. That is our message for this week.
Keep going with Judy. I want to hear what happened.
So, Judy's new plan was to use Christina and Daniel to kill John.
What happened to doing it herself?
Well, this is...
She
this
still
is,
doesn't want her hands to get dirty.
Dude, this bitch-ass pussy.
She's a prim and proper millionaire cul-de-sac wife.
I don't want to hear it. She's the office whore, and that will forever be her name.
So she wants to use Christina and Daniel to do the job now. So she gives them money to go buy a 25 caliber pistol, which Christina went and bought and must have gotten illegally, because she's like 17 at the time.
Or she just flashed her tits.
Yeah, well...
I hate to say it, but considering she was being
that's also
by
legal child pornography.
Oh, you're right.
Also illegal. They also bought dark clothing and a mask.
Spooky.
On the evening of April 17th, 2003, John Parker and Judy were enjoying a nice dinner at the patio restaurant in Merrillville. It was their 10th wedding anniversary, actually, when Christina called him and said that one of the kids left something in his office that they needed for homework. You know, just like, oh, I left like a book in your office or whatever. Can you go get it for us?
Yeah.
So being the great dad that he was, he like left dinner with Judy. And the two of them took the 6-minute drive over to his office in the man's Cadillac.
Sexy.
When John got out of his car and went towards the office, Daniel snuck up behind him, dressed in the dark clothes and with a mask covering his face, and shot him in the back of the head, execution style. Boom. Like, just done. Over with.
Point blank, period.
People nearby heard the gunshot and called 911 while Judy took John's wallet in an attempt to make the killing look like a robbery. However,
she's not
fucking
very fucking smart
because she left John's $20,000 Rolex watch and his jewelry on him, which obviously would convince the police that this wasn't a robbery.
Yeah.
Like, no fucking shit.
Yeah.
Who takes your wallet, which probably had, like, I don't know, credit cards, maybe some cash, and not the $20,000 Rolex?
Are you dumb?
Someone Stupid. Who don't know watches, that's who.
Yeah.
Stupid.
After the murder, Judy rushed her kids back to the house, where they showered and got rid of all the evidence, while Judy stayed at the scene and called the police to answer their questions when they arrived. When police officers asked her what happened, Judy told them that she had been sitting in the passenger seat of the car when someone ran up to John, shot and robbed him, and ran off before she could get a good look at him. The police were immediately suspicious because of the randomness of the killing and the fact that he still had the insanely expensive watch and jewelry on. Like, this was no robbery. There was more to this than just that. There's another reason that the police were suspicious of Judy, though, and this has to do more with general murder statistics. So there's a saying that I'm sure many people have heard before, that most homicides can be solved just by looking at the family.
And it is true. Like,
yeah, a lot of it happens. And spouses, either the husband or wife, it's more common in, like, husbands will kill the wife, but spouses are usually the first suspects in any murder case. In fact, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, 30% of all homicides in the U.S. are
Mariticide.
Or one spouse killing the other. So 30% of all homicides are mariticide, which
That's
is crazy.
Insane.
For this reason, it's typical for police to immediately suspect the spouse in any murder case.
Yeah.
But on top of this, Judy was also on the scene right next to where John was killed. Though Judy
so
denied,
she literally admitted to being there.
Yeah.
Like,
she was right there, and like immediately they're like, yeah, let's see what she knows. Though Judy denied having anything to do with the killing, reports from locals and family members began pouring in to the police department, and police recalled the two boys that Daniel had paid to kill his stepfather, and the pieces started to come together.
In hindsight, Thank the God. Pieces should have come together a long time before
this,
but oh well. Anyway, on April 21st, I just had a stroke there for a second, Daniel was brought in for questioning, and although he denied killing John, he did admit that he was part of the failed plot to hire the two boys, and for this, charges were filed against him. However, since Daniel was a minor and his mother couldn't give him permission to speak since she was also suspected in the case, the charges were dropped because his statements were not technically admissible in court.
That's a bit of a confusing situation, but basically when you're, if I understand this correctly, when you're a minor, you're... Like
a parent or
your
legal
guardian
has to
allow you to speak to the police, basically.
Bullshit.
But Judy was suspected in the case, and so she couldn't give that permission. And so
legally,
technically, since Daniel didn't have permission, all of his confession was out the window.
That's bullshit.
They couldn't do anything
couldn't
with
do
it.
Anything with
I
it.
Hate to say that. Bullshit.
It just that's
yes,
just
it
the
is
bullshit.
Bullshit. Yes. But, I mean, those rules are there to protect people in other cases. It just so happens that in this case,
it
backfired.
Yeah. Incredibly, at this point, the police had nothing on Judy or the kids that they could use, so they went on living their lives normally. Judy moved in with her new boyfriend, one of John's ex-employees, and continued to run the business. But she didn't get John's life insurance policy because his family disputed it. Go them.
I mean, that's fine, though. That was, like, the $1 million policy. But, like, the business was one of the top businesses in the area.
Yeah.
So she was still raking
in money. Oh, yeah.
She
was still making plenty of money.
Oh, yeah.
For years, nothing happened legally, and Daniel ended up moving to Arizona to live with his biological father, and Christina got married and had two kids, Alexis and Nathan. It honestly seemed like Judy, Daniel, and Christina were going to get away with their awful crime, but one minor slip-up led to it all falling apart. In February of 2006, Christina's husband was brought in on marijuana charges, and police began asking him about the murder of John Parker.
Like, they realized the opportunity that they had, and that if they were going to get any information, if they were ever going to solve this case, they had to do it now.
Yeah.
It was now or never.
Eventually, he gave up that Daniel shot John, Christina bought the gun, and Judy planned the whole thing.
How did he know that?
Well, yeah, I mean,
He's
he was
married to
Christina.
She must have told him.
Okay.
Yeah. This was more than the police could have ever asked for, and when they brought in Christina for questioning, she spilled her guts, the whole thing. The next day, Daniel was arrested in Chandler, Arizona, and confirmed what Christina had already told police. After receiving these confessions, the police were able to move on to Judy herself and arrested her as well. On August 20th, 2009, Judy was sentenced to 33 years in prison.
Fuck yeah.
On September 14th, Daniel was sentenced to 23 years, and on September 17th, Christina was sentenced to 5 years.
Fuck yeah.
Because technically, she didn't have a whole lot to do with it, but she was still a part of it.
She was an accomplice. She bought the gun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she knew about it.
But she was also the one to, like, tell the entire story initially.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So she probably, because of cooperating, she got a deal.
Yeah, and I was going to say, just thinking about it, she probably pled guilty where Judy might not have or something like that.
Yeah, like, the whole thing is that, like, police were blown away that through this entire process, Judy consistently put everybody else to blame in front of her first, including her own children.
Even her own kids.
Well, yeah, she was the office whore.
Yeah.
After her release from prison in 2013, Christina died from a drug overdose. Daniel was released from prison in January of 2016, and Judy will be up for parole for the first time in 2024.
And that's where it ends. This one really threw me for an absolute fucking loop. Like,
that one was like, that was some sitcom bullshit right there with like the four different attempts at murder. Yeah. Like, that was just wacky.
There like, was a lot of like back and forth and like, wait, she didn't get it, and then...
She must have been getting so fucking frustrated too. Like, how is this man not fucking dead yet?
She's like, the movies make it look so easy. How is this not panning out like I wanted to?
So, there's like this thing that's like, and then I fired, and I missed, and then I fired, and then I missed, and then I fired. Two shots, and I missed twice, both times. And this went on for several hours. That's literally what Judy is doing right now.
Something that kind of confused me through, like, in this case, was why were Daniel and Christina so willing to go along with it,
because
I guess?
Because they were the ones who grew up with Christina, or that with Judy as a bad mother.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, it just... I know that they were in a very hard situation, and again, Daniel said that sometimes John would be a little harsh on them. So I guess in his mind, he probably saw John as a bad
person. The bad guy, yeah.
But also, in a later interview, Daniel said that he was, like, brainwashed by his mother. So,
well, at the time, he might not have realized that.
Considering his mom literally was like, yeah, go to school and hire kids to murder your stepdad. Especially since
your mom telling you that, like, here's your peanut butter and jelly, have a good day at school, sweetie, and oh, don't forget what we talked about, make sure you find someone to bump off your stepdad, bye.
And it was thousands of dollars too. Like, this wasn't a little bit of money.
No, it was 10,000, you said, right?
It was either 6,000 or 12,000,
because
in what the stuff that we read, it said they were caught like flashing around $6,000. We don't know if that meant each one of them had 6,000 or like together they had 6,000.
I think it was 6,000 total, but
that's
we
what
really
I'm guessing too. Yeah,
I gotcha. It makes sense though, considering, especially since they were her first kids who like literally grew up with her in poverty, like growing up being what she was.
Yeah, and when you go through that struggle together, like you become blindly loyal, honestly.
Yeah.
And even it's their mom.
Yeah.
Like, most people say, oh, I'd do anything for my mom. Well,
here we are.
What exactly would you do?
Yeah. And in another interview, Christina said that Judy told her that John was abusing her and like sexually assaulting her and raping her. So, like, I guess in that situation. Yeah, exactly. Judy horribly manipulated her children into getting what she wanted.
What happened to the other kids that her and John had together?
No clue.
It
was incredibly hard to find any information about them, period.
So Judy kept custody over all of her children, including the two that she had with John. John's family was livid about that. Like, they did not want her to have custody. But again, the police couldn't prove anything against Judy, so there was no reason for Judy not to have them, essentially. I know in some other statements that we read, I think those two girls are now living with John's parents.
Thank goodness.
Yeah, and John's dad apparently said that he, like, completely forgave the whole family, especially Christina, because of, like, her little part in it. But he said, like, that's just the good Christian thing to do. And
I mean, so nice.
I mean,
can you imagine having that much, like, forgiveness in your life? I don't think I would ever
It just breaks my heart to know that she tore apart this amazing family that gave her everything in
life.
Like, John absolutely loved her. He had an amazing family around him. And then just out of nowhere, like, he trusted and loved Judy so much that he didn't even believe that, like, this hitman that told him Judy's trying to kill you. He just, like, didn't even believe it. That's how much he trusted and cared and loved Judy.
You can't trust thoughts.
That breaks my heart so much.
Never trust a hoe.
Never trust a hoe because they don't get cold.
You can't trust somebody that doesn't get cold. They have to be hiding something.
Exactly.
All right, we're going to start wrapping this up. That's all we've got for you this week. Thank you for listening. And if you like what we do, please share us around with your friends and family.
Around the holidays.
Yay.
Because that's what's coming up.
Don't forget to find us on Instagram at RuleOf3333. And again, if you've missed any previous episodes, you can go listen to them wherever podcasts are available. They're all posted, so listen to them whenever you'd like. We only have one more episode for this season of Rule of Three, and that's going to be...
It's kind of sad.
That is very sad.
Depressing.
Very sad.
It really
sad.
Is. Like,
forever.
Think about... Okay, this is going to get a little bit sappy for a minute, but, like, think about when we started this.
It feels like we just started.
Our first episode... I remember sitting here the whole time feeling like I was going to pass out.
Yeah, shit in my
pants. My heart was beating out of my chest. I was so terrified. And now I'm like, this is like my favorite thing ever.
This show has absolutely made my semester. Like, this has been the highlight of my college career so far.
It's pretty fun.
Yeah, we only have one episode left of season one, and that's going to be our Christmas special. So we're going to be recording that this weekend, but we're not going to release it until Christmas, so you're going to have to wait until then to hear it from us again.
Merry Christmas to
again,
you,
that's going
to
be your happy Christmas surprise, so yay for that, I guess.
Yay!
That's not the only thing that's going to be going out over break, though. I'm going to be starting a small series on my own, sadly. You're going to have to listen to the most boring out of the three of us.
That's not true.
But I'm going to be going more in depth on some stories that we've covered before, and maybe some stories that just didn't quite make the cut. So I'm going to be making little...
Yeah, because there's been a few that we had to, like, we had in consideration that we cut out, so...
Yeah, so I'm going to be doing that. I'm going to be making little mini episodes, just really short, just something to kind of fill the time, so...
We're also going to keep active on our social media, hopefully, so that you guys can see a little bit from us, and, like, maybe, because we realize we never formally introduced ourselves at all
to our audience.
They don't know who we are or what we do or what we're even doing here. Yeah. So maybe while we're home, it would be a good opportunity to kind of show them around a little bit, a little sneak peek into our lives. So
this was the last regular episode for season one, but there's going to be a lot more content coming on the way, and I am so excited for season two.
Season two is going to be an absolute banger.
Second
we have so many good ideas.
Cheeks.
We have a ton of good ideas. We're going to be building up a whole calendar. If you guys have any ideas, feel free to send them into us on Instagram. That's all we have for this week, so again, thank you guys for this amazing semester. I've loved doing this. Thank you everybody for listening, and we'll see you again at Christmas. Goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye guys.